These days, we kind of expect writers and thinkers to specialize in one or two areas, but over the course of his career, Simon Sharma has resisted being pigeonholed. Although he's a professor of history and art history at Columbia University, during his prolific career, he's mixed scholarly work and popular writing on a broad range of topics from travel to politics, community to landscape, and, of course, art and history. He's also written and been the host of numerous television documentaries, including the award-winning Power of Art. Mr. Sharma's most recent book, Scribble, 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 Writing on Politics, Ice Cream, Churchill, and My Mother, is a collection of essays, articles, and reviews. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hi.
Hey, thank you for having me again.
You began your career as an academic historian. When did you start writing journalistic pieces?
I must interrupt you, Leonard, because beginning the career as an academic historian presupposes I've stopped it, and my students would be distressed to hear that.
No, but I said in the introduction, yeah. you're doing those
things. No, that's right. That's right. I did.
You branched out.
I did. It happened, actually, for the TLS, as a matter of fact, when a good friend of mine called John Gross became editor, and he was the one who took the revolutionary step. Two things, of actually having signed pieces for a start, and also asking people to review art shows. And actually, I was working on the relationship between Dutch history and Dutch painting at the time. And he wanted kind of regular little art column pieces from me, and that was in the 70s. I had, however, been a kind of journalism junkie. I was inevitably the kid who had to be editor of the slightly dull school magazine and create a completely unnecessary alternative newspaper at Cambridge University. So I had, as I say, the kind of hot metal romance really pretty early on.
But did you ever feel pressured to concentrate on one or the other?
You know, I was incredibly lucky. I had a professor who some of your listeners may remember called J.H. Plum, partly because he spent a lot of time in New York. And when I was a student in Cambridge in the 1960s, there were two schools. One was that you were only a real historian insofar as you never went near journalism, that you did your monastic duty in the archive, and that was it. And heaven forbid you should ever do any kind of popular writing. Plum had the opposite. He was a grocer's kid. He was a lower middle class kid from the British Midlands. He himself had an amazing journalistic flair. He wrote for American Heritage. He gave me a book review for the Saturday Evening Post. That's how old I am. And I remember it well. It was a review of a book about the Battle of Waterloo by a man called David Howth. And I got paid $15, I think, by Saturday. And I was really proud. And his view was the opposite, that you couldn't be a good scholar unless you really had a touch for popular writing and vice versa. So that was a big unlooked-for present he gave me. You could hold your head up high and say, my scholarship and my popular writing are not mutually depleting. They're mutually nourishing.
Well, all good history writing is a kind of a dialogue between the past and the present, but you're actually doing it literally.
I suppose. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, you know, let's invoke Thucydides, really. It's time we had that at
we haven't invoked him in days.
Well, I'm very surprised to hear that, given, you know, Professor Lopate's amazing erudition. But, you know, he wasn't really a professor. Thucydides was a protagonist in the conflict he described. He was a general who'd been fired for, you know, incompetence, really, on the Northern Front. So his sense was an unembarrassed idea that really history speaks to now, and it shouldn't be really apologetic about that. And I suppose, you know, it's a bit pretentious to say I've inherited that, but I don't feel ashamed about that.
Well, the title of the book, as well as your writing style here, suggests a kind of stream of consciousness, a need to commit your thoughts on paper just as they occur to you. Now, this is kind of like personal essay approach.
Well, how interesting you say.
You're not a Montaigne type, are you?
No one in their right mind. No, people confuse me with Rabelais, Leonard, rather than Montaigne. I'm Carnival rather than Lent, as you well know, hence the foodie pieces. But how interesting, I was going to say that I think, you know, I teach a course at Columbia in the writing school called The Art of the Essay. And I was struck, there were some very, very good students a couple of years ago in that, but I was struck how much the blog has actually deformed the essay into a kind of indiscriminate effusion of free associations. Whatever's happening to me has got to be interesting to someone out there, and I hope it's a lot of someone's out there. And that seems to me to be absolutely the opposite from the formed essay, which has its own structure, its own, I've called it a dramaturgy. I mean, the great exponents like William Hazlitt and George Orwell and, Lamb, but also in the American tradition too, Twain, Truman Capote and so on, have been incredibly self-consciously artful about the pace of the essay, about what you withhold, as much as a great short story writer. There's my, you know, great classical instance of that is an essay by George Orwell called Leo Tolstoy and the Fool. And it would really spoil it to everybody out there to tell you, but it has a kind of punch, it has a kind of twist at the end of that essay, which comes up and absolutely seizes you, and incredibly cunningly, brilliantly plotted by George Orwell. And that's a tough thing. Those I do love doing, yeah.
Well, this book does cover a wide range of topics. Is there anything that you wouldn't want to write about?
I'm not great at automobile repair, actually. Are you surprised?
But you do write quite a bit about travel and food. You mentioned food earlier.
I love food, yes. I love food writing. And I have a column now, actually.
Food writing presents a lot of problems, doesn't it? Because you say food writing is simultaneously most challenging and most rewarding. What's the challenging and part? I can understand the rewarding part.
The consumption bit, I guess.
Stuff.
Yes, that's it. You got it. Exactly. Because, you know, big cook and foodie you are. I think actually in the sense of actually thinking about sources, ingredients and all those things, you know, even looking at what happens chemically to food as you braise it or roast it or grill it or whatever, that all can, you know, there can be a one-to-one relationship between your writing and what you're actually observing. It's when it actually happens in your mouth, actually when the palate and the nose and aroma and those things, then it's, I'm not going to be so pretentious to say, it's like the complication of writing about music. But essentially there is a disconnect between what you've got in your hands when you're using words and the experience actually of enjoying the food. And there you risk going into bad poetry, into nauseating in the literal sense cliche. And, you know, that's where you sometimes, even for me, have to put on the brakes.
The adjectives become a problem. The metaphors become a problem.
Yeah, it's like wine writing, you know, blackberry, cedar, cigar. Give me a break.
A hint of saddle. I always wondered about that. But wouldn't that also apply to writing about art?
It does a bit, and actually,
you're trying to explain something visual in words, and always work.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And I think actually there was a time when that was a self-conscious anxiety about people who wrote about art. In the 18th century, the early writers about art, like Jonathan Richardson and even Horace Walpole, chose on the side of understatement, you know, very dry account, actually, of the line of Tiepolo or whatever it was going to be, or the kind of the staffage of whichever Italian landscape painter they were describing. And then it really, Hazlitt, who is, my God, really an essay writing, does venture a little bit into a kind of poetic idiom, but however, without going the whole hog, which John Ruskin does, trying to imitate in his writing the nature of the brush. What Ruskin does when he really loses control in a wonderful way, when he writes about Turner, is that his whole kind of grammar disintegrates into a kind of mad melody, as if he were wielding Turner's own brush. And, well, that's going to sort of get you into trouble, I think.
You make an effort to separate food writers from writers who integrate food into larger conversations and topics.
How do you mean? Don't go
well. There are people who just, well, for example, about your peers in the university, you write, high politics turned us off as much as au cuisine, but here you are writing a great deal about both politics and sophisticated food today.
Well, I think it's certainly true that a lot of what I want to write about actually involves a very expansive view of human experience, and that sort of includes the way politics and, you know, eating came together. I'll tell you a story that
some people see talking a lot about food as elitist, and they're turned off by it.
Well, but you can talk.
At least listeners.
Yeah, is that right? But then they should read Calvin Trillin, for example. You know, the Tummy Trilogy, where you have, you know, fantastically funny, sharp commentary, really, on ribs and the best thing. And you learn a lot about the world as well about Bud Trilling and Kansas City.
There's also Elizabeth David, who writes beautifully about food and...
Yeah, do you know, someone came up to me and said, well, I adore Elizabeth David, but I don't believe she ever cooked anything in her books. I said, you're absolutely wrong. But she said that the most anecdotal, richly narrativized versions of a little place she found in France proved that she just... And it's quite true about Elizabeth David, which I rather love. There are no formal list of ingredients. If you know that, there are lists of ingredients, but they're not kind of listed in terms of exact quantities. But I rather love the sense in which it flowed naturally out of memory.
My guest is Simon Sharma, whose latest book is Scribble, 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 Writing on Politics, Ice Cream, Churchill, and My Mother. You were raised and educated in Britain and also started your career there. But haven't you lived in the United States for...
30-something years, yeah, since 1980.
Over half your life. So how long do you have to be an expat before you start identifying with the new place?
Oh, about half an hour, I think, actually.
I mean, do you think of yourself as an American these days?
I think of myself, I don't know. I mean, it really depends. I do think of myself having this double identity. I mean, my old mentor, Richard Cobb, who had a kind of Anglo-French double identity, said one need not really adulterate or dilute the other. And I suppose it's a bit greedy of me, but I sort of need and delight in both these identities. I mean, I'm not, you know, that sort of I came from the kind of Jewish background in which some of the family, the more enterprising ones, came to Britain from Russia, then found their way to Liverpool or Tilbury Docks and went to the place they were supposed to be going to, namely New York. Then there was the lazy one, my grandfather Mark, who said, I've slept enough already, I'm going to stay here in London. So I was part of that. But when I came to New York, it seemed to me, you know, like Jewish London to the max. It seemed to me a place I'd already been to and already knew.
There's a real threat of disenchantment with the way we do politics today, and I'm talking about both in this country and in Britain, in the writing here. What are the problems? Structural, institutional, the way we choose our leaders?
No, I think the disenchantment is really maybe with the content of government. Yeah, I mean, do we also think that there's a problem about the nature of our election season? If so, and I'm catching up with myself, I think it's called money. I think there is a sense both, did you read this morning that, you know, despite the fact the budget deal was essentially hammered out in between, as a compromise between the White House and the different aspects of Congress, lobbyists still had their hand in the way the eventual thing came out. That is, so I think, genuinely alienating for people. But if, you know, there, the notion, you know, my Brit political persona, this will no doubt stick in the craw of many people listening to you now saying, not another Brit going on about, you know, American politics. But it is a good thing, I think, that there are, you know, you can't spend money in British politics, that the political season is just 3 weeks long for the election. And we've become sort of grotesquely a kind of an oligarchy contaminated with gigantic sums of money. In fact, we have returned to the British political system of Edward Gibbon and the Hanoverian 18th century, from which America was devised to escape in the first place, which was entirely about who's got the fatter wallet.
But you also, you write about Churchill here, not totally reverentially, although most British historians just seem to adore him.
Well, I mean, Churchill, you know, had his warts. That's what makes him deeply interesting. That's why I was so annoyed with the King's Speech. Did you see that?
I
love the film, but I thought, you know, it's got to have an obligatory Churchill moment because, hey, it's the 1930s, so somebody's got to dress up Timothy Spall in, you know, wobble his wattles and attempt to chew a cigar in order to have exactly the position Churchill did not take. Churchill was craven in his adulation of Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson. I thought, well, you know, it's interesting that Churchill was not always right, that he was not always indomitable, that he got things tremendously wrong. But, you know, nonetheless, I grew up in a generation that felt that through, you know, May 1940, you know, if Lord Halifax had become Prime Minister, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation because I'd be someone's lampshade.
On the other hand, I always wondered why the King had to give that speech. Couldn't he just have gotten some actor to do it? I understand Churchill even got actors to do his speeches.
I didn't know that, did he? I didn't know that. But, well, I think it was the dad. I did love Michael Gambon as George, as a terrifying George V. But I think it was because his father, you know, they were dizzy with the potential of this new medium radio.
We have very little time, but I wonder about you on television. Is that something that just happened by accident?
I think of a famous interminable performance about Velázquez's Las Meninas, and they said, my God, either he's very, very good or incredibly bad. We better find out. And they hired me then. And I'm devoted to television actually as a serious way of actually provoking debate while telling stories.
Well, you use the term the two lives of the historian. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I mean the life of the archive and the life of the market, the public marketplace of ideas. And I think my own life would be impoverished without trying to do both.
And television helps you to do that.
Oh, television, well, you reach millions, really, and you try and stir them up. I mean, history's function is not a walk down memory lane and having people feel good about the past. It's to make people lose sleep at night, and that's my aim in life.
Although we have the new media now, you say blogging allows for too much freedom. But
yeah, but it's all a terrible neurotic flicker. What I like, the kind of TV I like, is slower, harder, deeper.
Simon Sharma will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at 192 Books. That's between 21st and 22nd Street on 10th Avenue. And on April 26th, he'll be speaking with Tom Brokaw at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 8:15. For tickets, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Scribble, Scribble, Scribble from Echo.